Near FM.
UCD Press have just published a book called Enduring Ruin, and it's about the effect of war on Irish environments, rural, urban, natural and built up. And I have the author on the line here, who is Justin Dolan Stover. And I'm speaking to you, you're in Holland, is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. It's good to have
you. I'm in Amsterdam. I'm a research fellow currently with the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study. So I have a great benefit of being here and doing some of my work this term, yes.
Right. And where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan in the USA. And I did my graduate work in Dublin. So if you hear a slight accent, that's just because of the way the city rubbed off on me. And I'm currently, when I'm not liaising in Holland, I'm teaching at Idaho State University in the Western United States.
Right. Wow. So then what has you writing a book about the environmental destruction during the Irish Revolution?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the first thing I'd like to say is, you know, as the children's author Beverly Cleary said, if you don't see a book you want on the shelf, you should write it yourself.
I
studied the Irish Revolution, and I did so as a graduate student at UCD and then at Trinity. And as I was reading through the records and all the fine books that are published on the subject, I noticed that, you know, something was missing, and that is the effects of the war, the rebellion in 1916, the war that followed, and people's social interactions with one another were very much tied in with the ways in which the environment was affected and affected the conflict itself. And so I began to look at the documentary record and see that there is quite a lot of material on, say, the destruction of buildings, the felling of trees, the digging of trenches for ambushes and things like that. And it hadn't really been the centerpiece of any major study. So I decided to have a go.
Right. But is that not the same with all war? I mean, you see, in the Ukraine now, and, you know, you see the pictures on the TV, you see the destruction of beautiful buildings, you see the destruction of the land. So this really is the effect of all war.
It is. And oftentimes I think we are caught up with the politics of war and its immediate human impact. Obviously, the loss of a life far outweighs the loss of, you know, a tree or some kind of cityscape. But it is affected in the same way. So yes, all war affects the environment, similar to the ways all war affects human beings, I think.
Right. But you mentioned that the Irish Revolution, you think, inflicted unprecedented damage.
Yes, I think so. In a small, concentrated period of time, we see an immediate targeting of landscapes, either in the suppression of the Easter Rising or during the guerrilla phase of the conflict after 1919. We see the environment take a central role as a tool of war, actually, for the Irish Republican Army, and then as a victim of war when it comes to Crown Force reprisals against Irish rebels and those who supported them. I see the environment come front and center. But you're right, it is often the case historically that the environment suffers quite significantly.
Yes, but now, what, going back to what you say there about as a tool, war, what do you mean by that? Like, and give me even examples. Or
well, what I found is that in my studies and in the readings of the period, and certainly of the readings of specifically the Irish Revolution, and I think any student or even casual observer of the Irish Revolution would notice that the Irish forces, the rebel forces, are significantly outmanned and outgunned and at a disadvantage materially as we understand traditional warfare. Mm-hmm. And so guerrilla methods are adopted as a way to bring out conventional forces into vulnerable areas for ambush. And as a way to do that, the IRA and Kumanaman, passing intelligence and arms to guerrilla fighters, are using the environment to their advantage. And that advantage has to do with using natural resources, such as trees. And so an enemy convoy, for example, would be pursuing a bunch of rebels down a country road, or they'd be going down the same road that they'd habitually gone down before, and all of a sudden trees would be dropped in front of them, and then trees would be dropped behind them, and or they'd run into a trench that had been laid or a trap in the road. And this manipulation of the environment acted, I think, as they might say, a fifth column of support for the IRA. You're essentially, as in the sporting term, you're on your home field. You have home field advantage in so many ways. And there's a number of intelligence reports from British personnel who lament the fact that Ireland is covered to the extent it is with mountainous terrain or with trees or with inadequate roads. And so they're trying to fight a very conventional war, but in the British are, that is, in a very unconventional way, in which is a way in which the Irish forces can dictate the terms of engagement.
Now, how did you research this book? How did you get your information for it?
That's a great question. It's not anything to say that I was in any special archives or special collections. These are very much the same sources people have been using for the last 30 years to write the Irish Revolution. I'm just looking at them in a slightly different way. For instance, the Royal Irish Constabulary Police reports give a monthly breakdown of the amount of crime, political sedition in Ireland, and the movements of the Irish Volunteers and Cumann na mBan. And what I found in that is that they'll often give reports on, you know, how many trees they found were felled in an area, or in what ways were individuals, you know, seen or caught around quarries looking for dynamite and other explosive materials. And so the reports on Irish movements, seditious movements, or perceived as seditious movements, are in some of the records that people have looked at before. In other instances, some of the new releases, say, from the National Archives of Ireland, such as the Irish Compensation 1923 files, which deal with damage that was done to material possessions and environments during the Irish Civil War, those were just released in the last few years. And so we get a fresh kind of perspective on the variety and the extent of damage that was done in certain times. And of course, there was existing documentation of criminal injuries acts in which individuals would apply for compensation to material damage that was done either to their homes or their farms in the course of the conflict during the Irish Revolution. And so there's a very, I guess, new way of looking at old material, but then there's plenty of new material that's being brought out. I mentioned the Compensation Act 1923, but also the military service pensions that are being released in batches also give details of individuals' lives during this period, and a lot of them recount their experience in interacting with various environments. And so I'm looking at old material, I'm looking at new material. Witness statements of the Bureau of Military History are often very valuable. And so it was just a case of kind of reading through the lines, in a way, or against the grain, as they say, to find new arguments.
Right. Now, what got you interested in the Irish Revolution?
This might be a Freudian answer, but from a very young age, my mother would read me History of Ireland, poetry and literature of Ireland. And so in some ways, I don't know if I ever had a choice. I was very much indoctrinated with the history and literature of Ireland from a young age. But I think when I got to college, when I went to university, I studied at Central Michigan University in the States, and I had a professor named Tim O'Neill who turned me on to specifically Irish history as it pertained to the period of the First World War, so the Easter Rising and the War of Independence and the Civil War after. And I said, oh, geez, this is terribly fascinating. I remember reading Peter Hart's work at the time, and he said that Ireland is one of the best documented revolutions in history, and I thought I really would like to work with the primary source material from the archives and libraries in Ireland. And so when I got to UCD as an MA student, I then met Professor Michael Laffin, who's emeritus there, and of course I think quite a lot of individuals in Ireland have learned from Professor Laffin. But he really gave my interest, my hobby interest in the Irish Revolution, a great focus. As far as the environmental aspect, I've had the pleasure of working with a few colleagues, Ryan Jones, who's at the University of Oregon, and Kevin Marsh, who's at Idaho State University with myself, who do specifically environmental history. So it's only through my work in proximity to them that I was able to put the pieces together regarding my love for Ireland and in the modern period, and the methodological view of Ireland through an environmental lens.
And is it all historical works that you do, or, you know, we're all talking about environment and how we can save the planet these days? So are you looking to help in any way towards the future of the environment?
Absolutely. This is something that as a historian, you know, you're constantly looking backwards. But I think we need to take a responsibility and look to the present and the future with our work as well. And I think if this particular book allows people to consider the environment as it has been interacted with throughout history, then there might be room to think about how we interact with the environment in the present and going forward. I don't talk enough in the book, and because it is based in the past, about the longer term, maybe effects of the war. But anyone who's looking into the environmental history of Ireland in over several centuries, we'll see, for example, the ways in which the trees have disappeared from the island over the past 1,000 years for a variety of reasons. We'll look at the ways in which turf is being used and developed. And these resources, as trees have shown us, are very finite. And so when it comes to turf production, which is also finite in its own regard, perhaps an environmental history will continue to have environment as a buzzword in people's heads. And we'll start to ask questions about sustainability and the future of, say, wind cultivation, tide cultivation for power. And this is specifically, I think, relevant in the event that Europe is facing an energy crisis with the conflict in Ukraine, as mentioned earlier. But ultimately, I'd love to see someone take a look at this book and say, wow, there was a lot of trees were felled during the revolution, take it upon themselves to go to their local nursery, grab a tree and put it in the ground. It's not the aim of the book to have that kind of environmental activist voice, but now that I have this audience, I'd certainly support moves toward that end.
Yes. So it would be lovely. That would be a lovely idea, and especially with Christmas coming, people could plant more trees. That would be great. Now, you say that your mum was reading these Irish stories. So is your mum originally from Ireland, or were her parents?
Well, like so many millions of Americans,
yes.
we all believe that we all come from Ireland, and was, you know, that kind of thing. To be honest, we've not found the exact paperwork for the family history, but as the legend goes, her grandfather emigrated at the turn of the 20th century. So I use her maiden name was Dolan, and she gave it to me as middle name. So to honor her, I use it in my work.
Right.
But as far as we know, we come from the Dolans of Galway, and her grandfather emigrated at the turn of the 20th century, and there's great programs like, I think it's pedigree.com or ancestry.com, I think it is, in which you can trace this back. And we've done a little family genealogy and found that indeed, our people come from the west of Ireland. But like I said, so many millions of Americans claim that. It's tough to get the paperwork in order sometimes. But certainly it's been an adopted family tradition to indulge in the history and literature of Ireland.
Yes. You know, you sound a bit like Michael Flatley.
Really?
Is he from the same area as you? You're saying that you're from Michigan, is it?
Yes, right, yeah.
I'm just wondering.
Well, I don't move like Michael Flatley. I can tell you that.
Oh my goodness, I don't think anyone does. My goodness. Amazing. Now, and the Stover, what's the Stover part of your name from?
Stover comes from my dad. That's actually the side of the family we do have documentation for. Stover, I think, comes from some sort of Germanic name, but his side of the family came from Turkey and Syria, and somehow got changed to Stover at Ellis Island when the family came over. But I have a really fascinating document from my dad's side of the family of his great-grandmother who emigrated at the turn of the 20th century. And it says on there that in order to gain access to the United States, you must forswear your allegiance to the Sultan. Because you remember, this part of the world is under the Ottoman Empire at the time. And so I found that to be a very cool document. But I think it's my mother's personality in the home that brought Irish and Irish culture and heritage to the forefront of our cultural education for my siblings and I, rather than the Near East, Middle East culture in the family. But I have documentation towards that end. So I guess we're a typical kind of American family that comes from a variety of backgrounds, all in the big melting pot.
Yes, big melting pot is right. Now, can I bring you back to your lovely book and go to part of it? You talk about the curse of Ananias. I can't even pronounce this.
Neither can I for the longest time until I talked to a biblical scholar, Ananias.
Ananias Greenwood. So yes, crown force, yes. Reprisals and displacement. So yes. Tell me about that.
In the National Library manuscripts room upstairs, and anyone who's been there can smell it right now, as I mentioned, that lovely room.
Yes.
In the Joseph Fowler papers, if my memory serves me correctly, there's a number of periodicals from the Irish organizations working abroad, and one of them is the Irish organization working in London, and it brings out its own magazine. The name of the magazine escapes me at the moment, but in the magazine, that was one of the headlines, is The Curse of Ananias Greenwood, and I remember reading that in the archive and saying, what is this about? And they're using a biblical reference to refer to Sir Hammer Greenwood, who was chief secretary for Ireland and under whom the majority of reprisals occurred, and they're referring to him as a liar, as Ananias was deemed to be a liar and a swindler in the New Testament. And they're making this comparison, one, because people would have had a biblical education. They would have known the connotation in which this word was being used. But also they're talking about lies and deceit of biblical proportions, because it's so plaguing Ireland, these reprisals, that they're calling out specifically the chief secretary and associating him with these lies. But that chapter in itself talks about the physical devastation to urban landscapes that occurs in throughout 1920 and 1921, and how reprisals effectively displaced so many thousands of people from their homes, in addition to destroying town centers. And we think of Balbriggan, and we think of the city of Cork, but we also have to think of this in a human context, that this isn't just a political act of retribution on the part of the Crown forces. This is a very intimate act, in that you've destroyed someone's home and everything they have associated with it, not merely material possessions, but they're also destroying memories of say, holidays past, or of intimate relationships that occur within the home. So that chapter in particular is one that builds on a lot of work that has come out previously on reprisals, such as that by David Leeson, on the Black and Tans in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds a very, very interesting book. So I think historians and environmentalists and anyone will really enjoy it.
I really hope so. I've written it kind of with a general tone, you know, for individuals to engage with. You don't have to be an expert in Irish history. But it also has the kind of endnotes and referencing and application of documentary evidence that would excite historians as well. And it's a quick read, I think. It's something that you can really, as you said, pick up for Christmas and have a read over your long holidays, if you like.
Very good. So where can people get this book then?
Well, in Ireland's finest bookshops, I'll say, point blank. But as I understand from the publisher, they can certainly get it from ucdpress.ie. You can order it online directly from the press. You can order it, or you can go in person to Hodges Figgis, which is one of my favorite bookshops.
Yes,
Books Upstairs on Dalier Street. We'll be having it. Is it Dunbray? Am I pronouncing that correctly? Books. I'm not sure. Or Dubarry.
Dubarry. Sure. Yes.
Dubarry. Yes. Thank you very much. So almost every bookshop in Ireland should have it stocked at the moment, and then if for some reason your local shop doesn't have it, I would say go to the press's website and you can find it there.
Very good. And it is called Enduring Ruin: Environmental Destruction During the Irish Revolution. It's been a joy to talk to you this morning, Justin.
And thank you for having me.
Not at all. And I wish you all the best with this current book that you probably have more in the pipeline, have you? You're on to your next.
I'm on to the. I'm going to take some time to put my feet up and think for a while,
yes.
And then maybe do a bit more work on environmental history. I really fancy it right now.
Yes, it's a very prevalent, as I say, like the environment is very prevalent in everybody's minds at the moment, and how we can try to save our planet. So looking back at how these wars, and you know, especially when we're in the middle of a current, you know, a current
yes.
war destroying a nation at the moment. It is a powerful read, I tell you. Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Not at all. Thank you so much for joining me. And I wish you a very happy and healthy Christmas.
Yes, happy Christmas to you and all your yes. listeners as well.
I know it's probably a bit early, but we are into
the end.
Oh,
that's never too early to say.
Never too early, yes, yes. Christmas blessings to you, Justin. Take care.
And to you.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, that was Justin Dolan Stover, and he's author of Enduring Ruin: Environmental Destruction During the Irish Revolution. And as he says, you can get onto UCD Press to purchase it, or go to bookstore near you.
Near FM.